You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported community radio, solar-powered, broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa.
And the sun is shining today, so we are solar-powered.
We are. And this is our Writer's Voices, which we recently celebrated our 9th anniversary during the show.
Oh, my gosh.
We started in October of 2006. So that's a lot of writers we've talked to over the years.
A lot of interesting people.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting books.
A lot of great books. I have so many of them.
Yeah, I know. The ones you don't have, I have. And I have a lot of books.
Yep. Well, we always did collect a lot of books.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, that's nothing new with me. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Well, who do we have with us today, Mom?
Today we have Gloria Dixon, who has written a very important book for all of us. And I know because I I went through this twice. And it's called After Death. When you lose a loved one, do you know what to do?
And Gloria Dixon is a CPA, an independent writer, and an ebook author with a BS in accounting and business and an MA in organizational management. She wrote this book after her husband, Charles, died following a long illness, and she thought she was prepared, but found out how much there really was to know and how hard it was to find that information in one place. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Gloria.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This is great to be able to talk to you and to help convey my message all the more. Thank you very much.
Now, Gloria, you live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I believe.
Yes, I do.
Yes. Yeah. And how long have you been there?
I've been here 39 years.
And this all, you were a CPA for most of that time?
Yes, most of that time I have been.
Right. So tell us how you came to write the book. I mean, I mentioned a little bit, but tell us a little bit more of that story and why you decided to write it.
You know, I've always been a writer, even in school and various organizations. Seems like I was always kind of the secretary of the organization for some reason. But I've journaled most of my adult life, and I've kept notes of life events. And Charles always wanted me to write about our journey with his disease, the leukemia. And so from the very start of that diagnosis in May 1994, of course, I've kept lots and lots of details of that disease and what we went through. So while sitting in the hospital, because as you can imagine, we were in and out of the hospital quite a bit over the last 20 years of his journey. So that gave me ample time to write and write and write. So as it got closer to the end of his life, of course, my notes started to change because now I needed to focus more on, you know, those last days, what things was happening, what I needed to do. And, of course, once he died, I had to kick it up a notch and implement those notes. So I made a checklist, and of course, that's the catalyst for writing After Death. I started to make a list of things, and since I needed the list, I thought I might as well convey this list to others.
And it's quite a list too. And the thing is, like you say in here, you need to have addresses and information about all these different entities.
That's absolutely
that's the secret to doing it, because when your loved one dies, doesn't matter whether it's been a lingering death or unexpected, you're still in shock.
Right, right.
But there are things that have to be done, and so it's good to be prepared.
Absolutely. And it's ironic because as a CPA, instead of going into tax or general accounting, I ended up in auditing. And that's the area where you have to be a skillful writer. So all of my basically accounting career has been in auditing, developing audit reports to officers and writing processes and procedures. So it just seems like a natural fit.
Now, were you surprised that you weren't as prepared for everything that you needed to do as you thought you were?
I was, because I knew that I had so many things in place, Charles and I. And to have these couple of hiccups, you know, I really was not expecting that to happen.
And have you talked to other people who were less prepared than you were and about their experience after someone they love dies?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The stories I could tell you from all of the, you know, the things I've done over the last year or so, people that have not been as prepared, it has been, Monica, it has been a nightmare. It has literally been a nightmare for them.
I'm sure it has.
And just talking to people in Fairfield, one of the people was telling me, I mean, there's some things that are still not resolved from a person that had died. You know, years ago.
Wow.
Well, if there's property, it makes it difficult.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And communication is so, so key.
Well, you know, there's some people that just, although we all know that death is inevitable, there are still some people who refuse to think about it.
Right.
And refuse to prepare for the inevitable. So I don't know why they do that, but that's, of course, in the case of people who lose someone very suddenly due to accident or something like that, I can understand that they're not prepared in any way. But people who have, you know, older people like myself, we have to be prepared.
We do. And I'm seeing this as quite a challenge, and really getting people to open up to my book. I realize it is challenging, and it's a taboo subject.
Yeah, right.
My book will be there when they are ready. Some people are ready now. Some people are thinking about it more. And some people are just not ready to even talk about it. But my book will be there when they're ready.
Yes, and it covers everything I could think of.
And the title of the book is After Death, When You Lose a Loved One, Do You Know What to Do? So, Mom, you've been in both situations, actually, with losing a spouse suddenly, very unexpectedly, and then, you know, a little more after a lengthy illness. Were you at all prepared? I mean, did you know what to do when Dad died, and how did you handle it?
No, I didn't know what to do, but you know, you remember Frosty Schwingles? He was a state senator.
Mm-hmm.
He's a friend of mine, and so he took care of some of the things that I needed to do for me.
Oh.
And of course, then when Ron died, of course he was prepared, you know, things, and he had a grown son who was in charge of his affairs. So I didn't have to deal with that.
You didn't have a lot of decisions to make.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Dad, of course, you did. And it was, you know, Gloria, when my father died, he was only 49. It was very unexpected, and he was on a trip. So he died hiking in the Grand Canyon.
Oh, my goodness.
With my younger brother, who was 21 at the time.
Wow.
And so not only was there the normal things to deal with when someone dies, there was actually the whole, well, first of all, we had, you know, there was suspicion of foul play because it was unexpected. So we had to get that cleared up.
Brian had to be interrogated, and I can only imagine.
Yeah. My brother was interrogated because he was there with him.
Sure.
And then there was arranging to get the body here. And then there was also getting my brother home.
Right. Well, they have to do an autopsy when you're out of state. They had to do an autopsy.
Mm.
And so they went to Flagstaff for that. And then we had some friends in out in California who flew to Flagstaff and drove Brian back.
Yeah.
So it worked out. And that that was, yeah.
But then, you know, it wasn't even simple then because Dad wanted, or we decided, I mean, he was too young to have actually really made his wishes clear, but we decided he'd want to be buried on his land, his rural land, which was about half an hour from Fairfield. But that's a whole different, you know, there's a lot of different rules and regulations as opposed to being buried in a cemetery.
Well, fortunately, we had a friend who was a supervisor, county supervisor, and so he handled that. So, you know, I've always said it pays to have a friend at court, and that really.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Gloria, your book, After Death, When You Lose a Loved One, Do You Know What to Do, is partially your story of losing your husband, and then also just a lot of checklists and for different circumstances. What are some of the different circumstances that you address, and how different are the checklists in those different circumstances?
The checklist, I have a chart that starts on page 5 in my book that really goes through the immediate things everyone need to do, no matter whether it's a spouse that dies or whether a child, parent, whoever. There are things that needs to be done immediately, like day one or shortly thereafter. So that chart, that checklist, is conducive to anyone that, you know, lose someone.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes through from contacting family members to preparing an obituary, those general things that's going to be applicable to anyone.
Right.
Whereas the next checklist goes through specific things for a spouse. For example, if she loses her mate or he loses his mate, those items, because of things that are specific to a marriage, may be slightly different than if you lose a parent or if you're an executor for a friend. So it really does go through some of the details specific to the individual that's being lost, that has been, you know, that has died. And I think it's really critical, because my checklist not only tell you if you lose your spouse what to do, for example, making the appointment with Social Security. Once I did make that call, they told me what to bring and what I didn't need. For example, the funeral home. They are required to contact Social Security upon a death. Social Security did not need me to provide a death certificate because they had already had that information. So these are the kinds of things I tell you in more detail. Other than just looking at the checklist, I give you what I did, what they asked me for, and then I tell you, once I met with Social Security, for example, the day that I met with them, 2 days later, I received my first survival benefit check. And not only that, I also received that one-time death benefit check of $255 in 2 days.
Wow.
That's pretty efficient.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yes, and no other book tell you that.
Wow.
No other book tell you what I did, when I did it, and the results.
Wow.
And I really, really, I would have loved to have had that information to have an idea, you know, what they were going to ask me for, what they would accept or what they won't accept, those kinds of things. So if you've been married as long as I was married, 40, 50 years, do you know where your original marriage license is?
No.
You need to know that. Don't accept a copy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So I tell you those pertinent details that I did not see anywhere else when I was, you know, Googling and researching.
Wow.
But this is what actually happened to me and what was required and what I provided and what I got and when.
You know, the $255 death benefit, that seems like that's a little out of, like maybe that was a reasonable death benefit in 1960, but it doesn't do anybody too much good now, does it?
No, it doesn't, but they still, that's the, you know, that's what they would give you if you lose, you know, if you lose a spouse or whatever, if you're eligible for that benefit, that's still the dollar amount after wow. all these years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you start putting this book together immediately after Charles's death?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Because during the hospital stay, the last few days, he was in hospice, and I was really, you knew that it was, you know, imminent.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to know, you know, the list was up to date. So once it happened, because my main focus was spending that time with him, those last hours, those last days. But once he died, then my focus had to change. I had to really start implementing some of those things. And immediately, as I started to make that checklist, I also thought I need to add more information for when I decide to write to others.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be communicated.
So you knew, even as you were going through this, you were thinking this will be a book.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Do you think that
find one? I could not find a book that would tell me this. You know, what is Social Security going to ask me for? I mean, you can go to their website. You're not going to, you know, they're not going to tell you you need your original marriage license.
Wow.
You know, and I don't know how many times since I've gone on book signings that people will say, I don't think I know where mine is.
Right. Most people probably don't.
And, you know, I've had actual experience where that has happened and the person has been able to get it before their spouse died.
Now, can you get a certified copy of the original marriage license from the courthouse? I mean,
yes,
okay.
Yes. Where you were married, you know, you can request that, and they will send you the original with the seal on it.
Okay, because otherwise, a lot of people would be out of luck.
Yeah, right. Oh gosh.
Yeah, and most people remember where they were married.
Yeah,
and state, county, that kind of thing.
Some churches also have a record of that. I don't know if that is a church record acceptable or not in this case, or does it have to be from the county?
You know, I'm not sure about that, Caroline, because I had mine, and you know, I just haven't pursued, you know, the other area as to what you need to do to get it.
Mm-hmm.
I just know I had mine, and I know they would not accept a copy.
Wow. Well, Gloria, why don't you read a little bit from the book so the listeners can get an idea of what this book is?
Okay, I would love to. I'm going to read from the chapter titled My Story of Inspiration. And this section begins with the lyrics from one of my favorite songs,
yeah.
Wind Beneath My Wings,
yes.
Or Hero. And it was written by Jeff Silbar and Larry Henley back in 1982. And it's critical that you remember, I want all of you to remember that this song was sung by Bette Midler during the Oscars last year on March 2nd, 2014. Mm-hmm. With written permission to include these lyrics in my book After Death, without a doubt, I think you will see that these words depict the inspiration behind the writing of this book. So it begins. It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face. You were content to let me shine. That's your way. You always walked a step behind. So I was the one with all the glory while you were the one with all the strength. A beautiful face without a name for so long. A beautiful smile to hide the pain. Did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I would like to be? I can fly higher than an eagle, for you are the wind beneath my wings. It might have appeared to go unnoticed, but I've got it all here in my heart. I want you to know I know the truth. Of course I know it. I would be nothing without you. Did you ever know that you're my hero? You're everything I wished I could be. I could fly higher than an eagle, for you are the wind beneath my wings. Fly, fly so high against the sky, so high I almost touched the sky. Thank you, thank you, thank God for you, the wind beneath my wings. On March 2nd, 2014, I turned my television on and watched the local news at 10 p.m., and the Oscars were still on. At that very moment, Bette Midler was singing Wind Beneath My Wings. Many of the movie stars in the audience sat with tears in their eyes, listening to the powerful lyrics as she sang. Then afterward, they applauded, giving Bette Midler a standing ovation for the emotional tribute sung to memorialize the late movie stars. How befitting, how emotional, how wonderfully she sang that night. As I looked at the various faces of the late movie stars in the memory gallery on the TV screen, I somehow blurred them out and could only see one face in my memory gallery. Charles Dixon, the wind beneath my wings, my hero. Did he ever know that he was my hero? Absolutely. It was November of 1967 when I first met this handsome, strong, valiant young man named Charles A. Dixon in Decatur, Illinois. Charles was a spiritual man, a visionary, a risk taker, an artist, a gifted mechanical engineer, and the most romantic man I'd ever known. On our very first date, he asked me to marry him, and I said unequivocally, "Are you crazy?" At the end of that first date, instead of trying to kiss me, he gently took my hand and kissed it. Less than a year later, we got married, had a son thereafter, and the rest is history. For the 4 to 6 years of our marriage, Charles always supported me in whatever I wanted to do. His words were, "Gloria, go for it." I did not earn my bachelor's and master's degrees until after I married Charles. He insisted that I continue my education while being a stay-at-home mom. In 1985, I sat for the CPA exam and passed it in the first sitting. By this time, our son was in high school and no longer needed me at home after school. I finally went to work in corporate America. During those years, I held positions such as tax accountant, auditor, IRS revenue agent, a college instructor, and a few others. Charles encouraged me to do it all. He was content to let me shine. That was his way. In 1993, our son invited his dad and me to Omaha, Nebraska, where he lived, to celebrate my birthday. Guess what song was sung at the party? You know it. Wind Beneath My Wings. Talk about emotional. This song has always been special to me. There were nights during our pillow talks, I would literally say to Charles, "You are everything I wished I could be." In May 1994, Charles was diagnosed with leukemia. Initially, his oncologist, Dr. Sharatan Ghosh, started him with medication. 2 years later, Charles agreed to have an autologous stem cell bone marrow transplant at the University of Minnesota, specifically Fairview Hospital in Minneapolis. He functioned really well for several years following the transplant. In 2006, I was working at Deering Company in Moline, Illinois, and left that position to manage our family-owned business called Dixon FYG Sprinkler Systems. Charles and I started Dixon FYG in 1995. Our company installed underground irrigation systems in residential and small commercial properties. Charles and I worked together every single day. Not only did we work together in the business world, but we also taught a Sunday school class together and presented at marriage workshops through our church ministry. I knew I was nothing without him. We definitely completed each other. Starting in 2006, I never missed another one of Charles's doctor's appointments, MRIs, x-rays, etc. I kept notes of everything with explicit details of his hospital stays. I was his medical advocate. In April of 2012, Charles lost the function of both kidneys and had to start dialysis. His health changed dramatically after about a year on dialysis. Countless times, Charles would express to me that he thought I was so strong in dealing with his illness, yet it was him who had all the strength. On January 13, 2014, Charles died. Our son and I were at his bedside at the very moment that he took his last breath. We rejoiced because we knew he was immediately in the presence of the Lord and out of his pain and suffering. And we cried because of the physical loss we were experiencing at the same time. Talk about a bittersweet experience. It's amazing, truly amazing, how God recently led me to read Isaiah 57:1-2, the New International Version, which states, "The righteous perish, and no one takes it to heart. The devout are taken away, and no one understands that the righteous are taken away to be spared from evil. Those who walk uprightly enter into peace. They find rest as they lie in death." Truly, Charles is now at rest in death. Apparently, I needed to read this scripture when I did, because God used death to take Charles away from his extended illness. And as I conclude this reading, during my many, many hours of writing this book after death, I could just hear Charles saying, "Gloria, go for it." At last, this book is written in loving memory of Charles A. Dixon. Thank you. Thank you. Thank God for you, Charles Dixon, the wind beneath my wings. Monica, Caroline.
Thank you, Gloria. That was Gloria Dixon reading from After Death, When You Lose a Loved One, Do You Know What to Do? Now, Mom, you've been through a loved one's dialysis, too.
Oh, yeah. My second husband was on dialysis for 8 years.
What?
Yeah, and finally he had other things happen during that time. He had a heart valve replaced and, he had so many things. He got an infection in his chest cavity and had to have that scraped off and stuff. That was the last surgery he had, but he never complained, not once.
I could understand that. Charles never complained either. He just thought I was so strong, but it was him.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, talking about being an advocate, when you're in the hospital for something serious and having a lot of different things done, you have to have somebody there, if you can, that can write things down.
Right.
Because I did that, and one time they came in and this doctor had wanted to know what was what all things were, and when he used to pass out and so forth, and so I had written it all down, and so I gave it to her, and she said, "Oh, the mother load." But she needed all that information.
Yes, so. it makes it so critical for someone to be mm-hmm. there to have that information.
Yeah.
Because the one that's sick, I mean, they're just not up to taking care of that kind of information.
Plus, sometimes the doctors aren't that good about listening, and you have to actually force it.
That's right.
You had some incidences of that too, didn't
you? Well, I had, yeah, right. He had broken a hip, and it went out numerous times, and they reconstructed it. And finally, I said, "You know, he has a curvature of the spine. I can see that when he walks down the hall in front of me. Sometimes, I can see it." And he said, "Oh, that doesn't make a difference." But in the last time they reconstructed it, the back man was there and the hip man was there, and it never went out again.
So you think maybe they did listen to you after all?
I think they did, yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, the side effect of certain medicines Charles was taking, they would not have known that had, you know, I was there to communicate that.
Right.
Some medicines he just could not.
Couldn't tolerate.
Yeah, could not work with his body, with his chemistry, and he had so many different things wrong that the doctors, every different doctor didn't know all the medical history that I knew.
Right. So you had the mother load.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's very important. It's very important. And I found, too, that, you know, I used to be, when I've had several surgeries in my life, and I always felt I was kind of at the mercy of the hospital, the nurses, and so forth, and I didn't speak up for things, but I found out you have to. You have to speak up. And don't be afraid to do it, because once when they brought the dialysis machine into his room, because they weren't sure what kind of disease he had, she was getting it ready, and she needed to change her gloves before starting, and I pointed that out to her. And she said, "Oh, yes, I need to do that." you know.
Wow. So, no, it's great to have someone else there with you, with that patient.
Yeah, it is.
So, Gloria, what do you think are some of the places where people get tripped up in the things that they have to do, where your book can be the most help?
What could be the most help is to, and I do have a section in my book, to start the process before the person or before you're not able to think.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things you can do in advance that will make it so much easier for those that are left behind. And I have a section that talks about before you die, to, you know, get those estate documents in place. You know, there's a whole list of things I mentioned in the book about, you know, the wills, those kinds of things. Your letter of instruction telling people what you want to happen to your body. Do you want to be buried? Do you want to be cremated? These kinds of decisions can be made well in advance of anyone getting sick.
Right.
And the more you can have written and communicated to that person that needs to know, oh, so much better.
That's the kind of thing that people are avoiding. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. But that's
Oh, and I tell people, once you make the decision, don't dwell on it. You don't have to dwell on it.
Right.
You know, but review it. You know, once a year, kind of go through those documents, make sure they're up to date,
mm-hmm.
beneficiary information. If something's changed, you know, you've gotten married or a baby's born, you need to get that information included.
Right. And you need phone numbers of insurance companies or whatever, where in bank, you know, banks and so forth. I mean, you have to have things at hand.
I have folders for my son. I mean, he knows what drawer everything's in, and folders with all my insurance policies, with the, you know, the face amount of the policy, 800 numbers, everything's in the folder, labeled, so he knows, you know, where the insurance companies are and how to reach them, those kinds of things. He's on my safe deposit box, so he knows where the number is, and he knows where the credit union is, and he knows where the key is. You know, the list of contents. There's a folder with that information. What's in that safe deposit box? If it's something he doesn't need to go to the safe deposit box. Mm-hmm. He already knows it's not in there.
Right.
So it's those kinds of things that I've asked people to really consider doing before something happens.
I can see where there's a lot of areas I could improve on there.
Yeah, well, you know, you're talking about bank accounts. You said that you have a joint account, but you should have a separate account.
Right.
You know,
right.
In your name only, and that's very important. I found that out.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of people don't think about that.
No, they don't. No. I did have that because my Social Security check came to that account, you know.
Now, how difficult is it, like, to transfer vehicle titles and that sort of thing?
You know, and I talk about that in the book because Charles and I, you know, our vehicles were paid off. So we had the way the title was written on the vehicles, it was Charles or Gloria. So because of that, it was easy for them to remove his name. They didn't require a death certificate or anything. Because it was stated that way, they took my word for that, mm-hmm. removed it for free. Had it been Gloria and Charles, it would have been a little more expensive.
See, that's a really important little tip that a lot of people probably don't realize.
Never think about. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, these are the things that I tell you that I went through and give you, you know, exactly what happened. So you don't have to guess. This is a true story. Mm-hmm. This is nonfiction. It's a true story. I don't probably have as much assets as Monica and Caroline, but because of what I put in the book about my assets, you know, you may have a little different twist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you may have more than I had at the time Charles died. But generally speaking, you know, I think most people have some of those things anyway that I mentioned that really are critical to getting through the death of a loved one.
Well, you know, after Monica's dad died, I read everything I could get my hands on to see if what I was feeling was normal.
Mm.
And And I found that it was. And, you know, because I had experienced, my father had died, but that was, you know, that's different. And so.
Speaking of that, Gloria, do you feel that writing this book in the aftermath of Charles's passing helped you to deal with that or made it more challenging?
I think it really helped. It was sort of therapeutic in a way. You know, it is part of my grieving, part of my healing process. But I tell people when they ask me that question, Monica, I'm still healing. And there are times, even though I've written so many things about our life in this first book, it's like, you know how if you bump a scab, it starts, you know, it makes that sore hurt again.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I'm healing, it's like sometimes you may say something to me or that sort of bump that sore and starts that hurting process all over again.
Well, I think sometimes in our society, because we keep death at a distance, you know, people don't tend to die at home. We don't have this, you know, the funeral home takes the bodies away. We don't have a lot of ritual surrounding death that maybe other societies and other times had. So the reasons for that is, you know, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it. So when you lose somebody that you really love, I think a lot of times people want to talk about it, want to keep talking about it, and yet the people around them don't want to listen or don't want to hear, or the person who is grieving thinks that other people don't want to listen. And in a sense, Gloria, because you're able to talk about Charles and about his death in a context that isn't just all about you know, that it's about helping others and giving information, that gives you more opportunity maybe to work through your feelings because you do get to talk about it.
Right. I totally agree with that too, mm-hmm. You know, and there are moments, Monica, Caroline, that, I mean, it really is emotional for me, and I, you know, I'm going to have those moments, and that's okay. I really think it's okay. I mean, I was with this man a long time.
Oh, absolutely. It's okay.
I mean, every day, there's not, I mean, he's ever present.
Right.
And so I enjoy talking about him. I do. I want to keep him alive. He's always going to be with me.
So, Gloria, in this chapter, you quoted from Wind Beneath My Wings, which it's very funny because right after I read this, I was at my son's house, and in their downstairs bathroom, there's a little plaque from that has my granddaughter's handprints made into a butterfly and the words, "You are the wind beneath my wings."
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Now, I was wondering, you know, you quoted this song with permission. What did it take? How did you go about getting the permissions for that?
Oh, my goodness. I have met so many wonderful people in this process, and one of them, I received an email back from Larry Henley. You know, this was written by Jeff Silbar and Larry. And so Larry himself emailed me back to tell me how to get the permission. So, I mean, I've made phone calls, emails after emails. The trail finally led me to the original writer and how to get the permission, because it's with Alfred Publishing Company in California, Van Nuys, California. So he steered me to the right people, and within days I had it.
So how do you, like, if he hadn't told you, how would you have found out? So apparently you have to get it from whoever owns the rights, which would normally be the publishing company.
Right.
How do you find out who the publishing company or who owns the rights for a song other than by getting lucky?
Well, when I went online to see the lyrics, to see if I could use them, and it tells you that it's copyrighted. And so you sort of can get the information from online to kind of steer you to the trail. And again, I mean, that was the way that, you know, that I went about finding how I could use the lyrics in my book, is finding out, you know, who had it copyrighted.
And is it expensive to get those rights?
It can be. My understanding, it varies tremendously. And in this instance, because my husband had died, they asked me for a copy of the manuscript for the section in which I was going to use the lyrics. And I'm sure because of the connection of the death, and I think they just had mercy on me.
Aww.
Because you won't believe how inexpensive this was to include the lyrics.
Wow. You know, when we started Writer's Voices, we were using the theme song from St. Elmo's Fire as the intro music. And we realized we needed to get permissions for it, and we started researching it. And it turned out that that particular song, what was the name of that song? Do you remember, Mom?
I can't remember. That's so long.
Anyway, it had a very convoluted ownership. It was owned by like three different groups, and it was very, very difficult and expensive to get rights to use it. And so we went with something else that was much simpler.
Good for you. But no, it can be expensive. It just depends, I'm sure, on the song and, you know, all the rights associated with it, who owns the rights and, you know, what it cost.
Absolutely.
But I was truly blessed because once, you know, they got my manuscript and saw the chapter I was using it in, I mean, it was just so nominal, Monica.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gloria, let's talk about publishing now. Who published your book and how did you go about that process?
Well, instead of using an agent, I decided to self-publish, and I thought about it briefly, just briefly, but I didn't. I know that agents require, you know, a commission on, you know, every sale, and I really thought I could, being an emerging author, that I could probably get a good start on my own. So I did I selected three different publishers. One in Cedar Rapids, one in Des Moines, one in Dubuque, Iowa, and looked at their estimate. And based on their itemized rate sheet, you know, because they break it down and they tell you exactly how much for design, content editing, printing costs, copyright, if they get the copyright and, you know, ISBN number, all of that was itemized. In my selection process, then I decided to meet with the different publishers, and from that meeting, I had to feel comfortable with the person that was going to do the publishing, that they understood what this book meant to me.
Mm.
And the company in Dubuque, Iowa, River Light Publishing Company, the team was so comfortable and so willing to work with me. What I wanted to do versus whatever I wanted them to do, they were real great about that, letting me pick and choose, sort of like a smorgasbord. So I designed the cover.
Which is beautiful.
It is. Very, very.
Thank you, because
nice.
I knew I had this vision in my head that I wanted Charles Pitcher on the book with me as if he was looking down on me from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went and got the photo done, you know, this, to me, that was just a no-brainer. This was going to be the cover. So it's things like that that helped me decide what publishing company that I was going to use, how much they would allow me to be a part of that process.
And did you print a number of, like, did you get a print run, or are you using print-on-demand?
Print-on-demand.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you use Lightning Source for that, you know?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Just the publisher, they outsource the printing to another company there.
Okay.
And so whenever I need to have 500 books or whatever, 200, whatever, you know, within a week, they're printed.
Great. That's amazing, really, isn't
it? Yeah.
So you said something about another book. You have another book in the offing?
I do. I have a second manuscript that I have about 16,000 words already written.
Oh.
So I'm off to a great start, and it is a continuation. It's sort of a sequel to After Death, except what I'm hearing from different, from just marketing my book, open houses, book signings, people that wanted to know more about how you and Charles met. They want to know, how did you get your spouse to talk about death? They want to know, and all of these things I could not put in this first book because I wanted people to focus on getting things done.
Yeah.
Different book altogether.
Right.
But it stems from that because now I feel more comfortable elaborating on the details of the relationship and on the disease. So I give you a lot more detail on leukemia, how we found out and what we did when we found out. I give you more detail on some of the things that have happened after his death that was so profound.
Gloria, would you like to share some of that book with us?
I do. I have a few minutes that I could just read a few, just from one section of the wedding ring chapter, and I think that's going to give you a very good flavor for how my next book is coming along.
Very good.
Ready?
Yes.
The wedding ring. So I'm going to just read from the chapter of the wedding ring. And it's not the entire chapter, just an excerpt. On January 18, 2014, something phenomenal happened to me, nothing short of a miracle. My husband, Charles A. Dixon, had been diagnosed with leukemia since 1994, and Charles died on January 13, 2014. We buried him on January 18 of 2014. After leaving the gravesite, family and friends returned to our home. About 8:30 that evening, my nephew, Preston, was looking for his cell phone that he had misplaced in the family room. He was searching the sofa when he cried out, holding up a silver wedding band. "Hey, did someone lose a ring?" My granddaughter, Ambrosia, looked at it and called out to me in an alarmingly loud voice, "Grandma, here's Grandpa's ring." I let go of all my emotions. I literally lost it. I had gotten through the visitation and burial services with reasonable outbursts of emotions, but to hear that Charles's ring had been found on the very night that we buried him was more than I could bear. It was early October 2013 when one late night Charles had gotten out of our bed to go downstairs to lie down. He was fidgety and quite restless, so in order not to keep me awake, he went downstairs. Charles would often go to another room to sit up or lay down when he was agitated. There's a recliner in our family room downstairs by the fireplace that he would often sometimes sit or recline in on nights that he was restless. Later, he may even move over to the sofa and stretch out. Nevertheless, countless times, I would find Charles's wedding ring on our nightstand or on the floor in our bedroom or on the floor in other rooms. But on that night, in October of 2013, when he took off his ring downstairs, apparently it had fallen between the crevice in the sofa. Charles and I looked and looked. We both took the pillow off the sofa. We moved coffee tables and accessories in the family room, hoping it had worked its way under them. We looked in the recliner, thinking it had fallen in its crevice. We vacuumed several times, hoping to hear a clinking sound, indicating we had sucked up something metal. For months, we looked for that ring. Finally, one day I asked Charles if we could go shopping for him another ring. It was approaching the Christmas season, and it would have made a wonderful Christmas gift to him from me. After all, I had purchased that ring in the late 60s. So now, I thought, I had the opportunity to buy him a ring that was of a little better quality. Well, Charles emphatically said, "No, we'll find it." After that declaration, I left it alone and never mentioned it again. Then to hear that Preston had found Charles's ring, not only that it was found, but it was found on the very night that we buried him, on January 18, 2014. For some reason, it was not meant for us to find his ring before he died. I think Charles knew that had we found the ring, I would have kept it on his finger and buried it with him. And now it seems clear to me that he wanted me to have his ring as a part of him, even after he was gone.
Yep, that's great. That is just...
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Gloria Dixon, author of After Death, When You Lose a Loved One, Do You Know What to Do? And she was reading there from her second book, which is As of Yet Untitled, correct?
Yes. Untitled as of yet.
But will be published in the near future.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a guardian angel moment as far as I'm concerned.
I know, it really took me aback.
So, Gloria, are you focusing full-time on writing and marketing your book?
No, as a matter of fact, I am going to be working during tax season at a CPA firm. So, I you know, that's going to help me promote my book without exhausting savings in the meantime, but and traveling. So I'm traveling, I'm going to be working part, you know, I'm going to be working with a CPA firm and working on my, writing on my book. I want to get it finished so I can get it published next year. But there are still so many things that are still happening that I might have to still include in my next book.
Mm. Now, it does seem like you have done a lot to promote the book. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you do that and some of the things that you've done and what's been successful for you and what hasn't worked as well?
Okay. Open houses. I've been doing a lot of open houses. I mean, that was the kickoff for my book because I wanted to introduce it to my family and close friends first. So open houses has been a biggie. House parties, clubhouses.
Like
the authors.
Book clubs?
Clubhouses where, you know, apartment have clubhouses and
okay.
They will have activities for the month for residents. And I've been invited to, you know, be on their calendar for the month.
Ah, very good.
So they have a clubhouse where they, you know, have activities.
Right. And is that, you're focusing maybe on senior apartments?
Yes, that's
yes.
been pretty,
yeah.
you know, the residents are mostly senior citizens. That is true.
Right.
Well, that's good.
That's been great, and the direct mailing. So I have been sending invitations out, you know, for sessions to do book signings and discussions. So I've been doing that. Networking has been the most viable because I've received so much from advertisement because of networking. For example, I've been on TV, KCRG. The Gazette, the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, yours truly, KRUUFM, and that's mostly due to Arnie Wolfson and Carol Kesser. Yay for them.
Yep. Thank you, Arnie and Carol Lee.
Yes. Yep. And then KMCD Radio AM in Fairfield. Mm-hmm. David interviewed me also, and I have several bookstores, and they're mostly independent bookstores. The African American Museum in Cedar Rapids, Beaverdale Bookstore in Des Moines, Mount Mercy University Campus Store, Prairie Light Bookstore in Iowa City, Revelation Cafe in Fairfield, and you know the owner is Betsy.
Yep.
And I am with, of course, the publisher, the bookstore, River Lights Bookstore in Dubuque, Iowa. So a series of bookstores, independent, of course. I have an author's page on Facebook. And if you notice, I have a campaign going. I will be in 50 states by the end of the year. Currently, I'm at 47 out of 50 states, my book.
Wow.
And what counts as being in the state? Just having someone read it, you know, someone having bought the book in that state or having distribution
right.
in the state? Okay.
Right. I mean, most of the penetration is in Iowa and Illinois because that's where, you know, my family and friends mostly are in customers.
And your book is available on Amazon, too.
Right.
And how about Barnes & Noble online? Is it available
there?
Oh,
all the e-books, Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble Nook, Apple, iTunes, and Kobo. So electronic,
great.
formats in all of them.
And did your publisher handle all of that, the electronic formatting?
Yes.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
And I'm in, you know, I've been in several magazines, and the one that I really want to mention, my book was interviewed in the International Association for Hospice and Palliative Care.
Oh.
The editor in Australia interviewed my book in the national newsletter.
Wonderful.
Yeah, because I do have a section in my book after that to, you know, help people consider hospice. They do such a wonderful job.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard of that. Well, this book is... You know,
If you need it.
You need this book. Everybody needs this book.
Yeah. And also, my upcoming book on YouTube, I uploaded a video recently that talks about the wedding ring phenomenon. So I'm doing some things to really bring attention to the book.
You're seeding the market.
Yeah.
Well, Gloria, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, to learn more about what to do when a loved one dies, and to hear your story.
This has been such a great opportunity for me to help get my message out. Thank you. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you, Gloria.
Stay on. I want her to stay. I want her to hear this.
Okay. So Mom has some closing words. She always does a quote at the end.
Well, this is...
Hey.
I'm not sure where I got this, but... this isn't just for her, but it's for a lot of people. Rest assured that your husband's love and concern for his family did not end with his passing into eternal life. From his place with the Father, that love spans the universe and manifests in thought, prayer, and precious memories.
That's it for Writers' Voices today. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile, where James Moore is interviewing artist Siona Benjamin, an artist who was raised in a near-mythical 2,000-year-old Jewish community in India. And her art reflects that background as well as her life here in America today. And we'll be rebroadcasting Monday morning, 8 a.m. So if you missed part of this.
Tell everybody
8 a.m. Monday morning. And see you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.